The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, another great pitch for another great company, or not. Peter gets bugged by the bugs. Simpson tells us about his technique. Doug starts provisioning. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much more on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Tuesday, April 25th, I will be at the RSA conference meeting Cyber Companies. Email us at thecybershow.co if you want to be interviewed there. Friday, April 28th, all afternoon, the CSUMB Startup Challenge finalists will be at the Otter Student Union. Contact the IIED at the university for details. Tuesday, May 2nd, our Angel to Exit monthly advisory session will be held live online remote. To join us, sign up at thecybershow.co. Tuesday, May 9th at 9 a.m. go to Angel. Present your company and get on the show. Tuesday, May 9th at 1 p.m., join the All.net members forum to discuss cybersecurity issues. For more details and to sign up, go to thecybershow.co.
For details on anything you hear about at The Cyber Show, go to thecybershow.co.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
Hi, Karthik. How you doing today?
Very good, Fred. Thanks for inviting me over.
Sure. And you run Krish Energy, right?
That is correct, out of Golden, Colorado.
Golden, Colorado. There you go. In the simplest terms you can, tell us what it is that your business does.
So we're providing the world's leading platform for sustainability performance tracking, certifications, and branding.
All right, hang on. All those long words, just tell us what you do.
Well, we basically do green audits, and then we certify restaurants and hotels on what their green performance is.
All right, when you say a green audit, I assume it's not the color of the paper. So what an audit is usually against the standard. So what do you compare them to in your audit?
So that's one of our secret sauce, is that we have our own auditing system. It's called the Peacock Pentagon Rating System for sustainability. So we've developed that. We've had that vetted through a lot of environmental experts. So we use that to do the audit. And then we also have some very cool features within that, in the sense that we are market-based rating system, meaning we rate you based on what your specific competitors are doing. So you can compare apples to apples, basically.
All right. So this is like going to high school, right? So some companies will have A's, but the average company in an area, the average hospitality in an area will have a C, right? And then the other ones, you know, there will be those that have bad grades. We won't talk about them. So basically, you're getting graded on a curve compared to the other restaurants and the other hospitality offerings in your area. Is that right?
Absolutely.
All right. So now Monterey is one of the most top-end, sustainable, eco-friendly places in the world. You know, the hotels here do all sorts of stuff to try and become sustainable. And so isn't it a little bit unfair when somebody looks at your rating and says, well, Monterey is no better than south side of Chicago, because, you know, there's a C here and a C there. So do you have some sort of grading that allows us to compare at the larger scale as well as locally?
Absolutely. So the purpose of Krish green signaling is it has to be easy to follow green ratings, meaning you can just look at the CUDA code, which will say, you know, equivalent to like C in Chicago versus C in Monterey, but then you can go into the details. So for example, Krish is very big on materials footprint. So if a company, if a restaurant based in Monterey Bay does a very good job of reducing organic waste going to landfills or reducing or eliminating single-use plastic, then whether it's in Chicago or in Monterey Bay, it's going to get a high rating. However, if someone within that locality says, hey, I'm doing all that, but my restaurant is has solar panels and uses 100% renewable energy, then that pushes the benchmark for them, that particular region. So people in Monterey Bay can have solar panels. Chicago, not all the time, because the weather patterns are different over there.
Well, there's also the sustainability of the fisheries, right? So a lot of folks around here have sustainable fisheries. They have organic food items. There's a lot of organic farming around here. They'll have, you know, heart healthy and so forth, right? So we're in an area, you know, and in the other parts of the country, you know, they call us the left coast, right? Because we're so heavily into this stuff. There's lots and lots of solar. In fact, in California, solar is effectively mandated, and zero carbon footprint is mandated on new housing projects and so forth. So there's all sorts of stuff that's in California that's going to be different for the rest of the country. So in terms of the grading system, obviously we'll look at your site and see more of the details of how that works. The other question is, we talked about this earlier. We talked about ESG, right? You know, environment, society, and governance. So you're focused on the E part, right?
That's correct. Now, I want to add to this. There is also an S, but it stands for sustainability, and societal has to be a subset of that. So environmental protection and sustainability, which is, I mean, there's a lot of disinformation floating around on this, and I've spent a lot of time giving lectures at universities and gathering community feedback. So I am for ENS, but in my terms, it is environmental protection, and it's for sustainable development, which is different from whatever ESG is doing, you know, from the investor standpoint.
Yeah, we have enormous sustainability programs around here as well. I mean, obviously, not just being on this coast, but also the Monterey Bay. I don't know if you know about the history. 100 years ago, it was just about dead. It had been killed by the overfishing and the logging and all the other industry pouring stuff into the bay. And the mayor of Pacific Grove basically stood up and said, no more. And that changed the political situation. It changed the whole environment. And now it's one of the, you know, most pristine areas in the world where you have large population near the ocean. So we've done a tremendous amount here for that. I'm hoping that we'll be able to get great grades.
Just add to that, Fred. I used to live in Woodside, California, just west of Palo Alto. I lived there for a little while, and I've been through the coastline and $5-10 million houses on the Monterey Beach. I've seen them. So I do. You remind me of some of the times I've spent physically in California.
Yeah, not to mention, you know, but I'm wearing almost like a Hawaiian shirt, so that probably gives you the casual. But they can't see that on the radio.
There's a drive into deep left field. Look out now. That ball is going. Going down. And the Rasky gets it over the left field fence for a home run. And the Pirates win it 10-9 and win the World Series.
For more details on this pitch and to view their Gee Whiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
To get in touch with companies presenting on the show, you can go to thecybershow.co and look them up.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. The term generative AI is now being used to describe anything they want to sell to investors. This augments the previous investor pitch line, bringing the new breakthrough in marketing technology to go like this. Our new and improved generative AI, cloud-based neural network deep learning solution, and so forth.
And now a word from our sponsor. Tuesday, April 25th, I will be at the RSA conference meeting Cyber Companies. Email us at thecybershow.co if you want to be interviewed there. Tuesday, May 2nd, our Angel to Exit monthly advisory session will be held live online remote. To join us, sign up at thecybershow.co. Tuesday, May 9th at 9 a.m. go to Angel. Present your company and get on the show. Tuesday, May 9th at 1 p.m. join the All.net members forum to discuss cybersecurity issues. For more details and to sign up, go to thecybershow.co.
During this segment of the show, we talk to historical figures from the cyber world. We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Peter Neumann. His long career exemplifies a great deal of the time and effort and expertise involved in the development of the cyber world that we live in today.
Like speculative execution, just doesn't make sense to most people. They've never heard the term. And the ones who have realize that it's a very nasty concept because of the covert channels and the the look ahead stuff of looking at things that aren't supposed to be executed. But remember that the very simple example of buffer overflow prediction in Multics was a preliminary to all of that. Nothing was executable if it wasn't in the stack frame. And the hardware protected that.
The rule of execution takes a fair amount of hardware.
That's true. But that's what we're doing in hardware in Cherry.
Yeah, but maybe what we should do instead is not have the speculative execution and have copies of hardware that do the execution.
Yeah, and then pick the right one when you get there.
Yeah, or just have them all run in parallel and just get the, you know, you're not saving time from A to B,
yeah.
But on average, you're getting a lot more done.
Yeah, but that's the problem. Some of those things are illegal. They should never have been executed in the first place.
That's what happens when you speculate.
That's right. So that's what you've got to protect against. And that was sort of what buffer overflows did in Multics in 1965. If it wasn't in the stack frame, it didn't get executed.
So I did microcode for the 114E.
Yeah, okay.
And we were, you know, implementing special instructions for doing optical processing, right?
Yeah, okay.
And one of the things you look at in that environment is you can simultaneously open a circuit from VCC to ground.
Yeah.
Something will fry.
Yes, right.
At which point we need to implement all the instructions differently.
Yeah.
So reprogramming the computer to do that, but that has a similar sort of problematic environment.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that, you know, you can connect too many things together if you don't understand voltages and currents and fan out and what's going on in the processor.
Yeah.
And the electronics of it, you can't get it to do the right thing. And the same is true with speculative execution.
But there's one more story I wanted to tell you.
Okay, I'll listen.
back in the BSIS, Bell Labs operating system times, there was a bug somewhere that caused the entire system to crash. It never happened while Vysotsky and McElroy and company were in the operating room. Okay.
First clue.
It only happened when they weren't there. Okay. So it took them a year to figure out what was happening.
Their not being there was making it upset. Right?
What was happening was that when they were in the room, the operators were all paying attention because they knew that the guys were there, right? Watching them like hawks. And when they weren't in the room, they got sloppy. And it had to do with timing on the buttons pushed on tape units.
I have had that experience.
And there was a race condition in the circuitry of the unit that if they pushed one button and another button too soon after it, that it crashed the whole system. And it literally took them a year to diagnose that one.
So sometimes the best diagnosis is a fist. We had some RAM, you know, these donuts, these magnets.
Yeah.
You know, that was just going bad. It was flaky and there were errors, but not enough errors to take it out.
Yeah.
But so many errors that you had to restart that machine like, you know, every 15 minutes.
Oh my God.
And eventually, not just restart the machine, there's a bunch of stuff you had to do to toggle in to change, you know, take out those memory locations. So I'm sitting there, you know, at night at the console doing that. And finally, this one bank of RAM was just bothering me too much. And I was just, bam. However many millions of parity errors later, however many seconds later, I was allowed to turn that memory off.
Yeah.
And then everything went fine.
Amazing. Wonderful.
You know, sometimes you have to shake a system, whack it. And that's another methodology. You know, that's what the random input sequences are.
Yeah.
They're so good at detecting problems.
Yeah. Fuzzing.
Okay. So, you know, all this, I've proven it works and I've done the mathematics and all this. No. Reality, the guys are in the room. Everybody's being careful. The system's never going to have a problem. As soon as they walk out of the room, they change the way they behave and everything falls over. And it takes a year to find it out. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. People have to realize that businesses work
in terms of they have a schedule, they have a budget, right? They have limited resources and they have requirements, and they have to balance all of these things in addition to balancing and making ethical decisions. And the world's not perfect and our systems aren't perfect. So, and tools like fuzzing, you just mentioned that, both of you in this interview. I've used fuzzing for finding vulnerabilities, which I think you find a little to be a little bit unethical, or at least
no.
But
that's not right. So there's okay. a difference between attempting to induce failures through specifically attacking things, find a vulnerability, find a mistake somebody made mm-hmm. in that methodology, and the fuzzing approach, which is what I'll call testing.
Yeah.
Right. And the difference between penetration testing and protection testing mm-hmm. is that protection testing, we have an assumption that the system is supposed to do something, and we're testing that it does what it's supposed to do, right? Okay. So it's an assumption that the system is supposed to protect against random input sequences, that any input sequence that shows up mm-hmm. will not cause whatever bad things to happen. That's the assumption that our protection methodology is put in place, like that it's limiting the input sequence to a particular length. Protection testing is try a longer length. So it's right. an assumption about what it's supposed to do, and we test to verify that it does do what it's supposed to do. That's completely different than this idea of I'm trying to find a way to break in.
Mm.
Because if it's not in the specification, if it's not in the list of things it's supposed to do, forget it. It's not going to do it. I mean, yeah, of course you'll be able to break in.
Right.
You know, it wasn't designed so you can't. It was designed so you can't access this file. Okay, we're going to try to access that file. But it wasn't designed to protect and prevent from every possible sequence of events that can occur. If it was designed for that, then we're going to do a test that has defined coverage of all of the event sequences. And we're going to try to cover that space by going to all the edges and exercising the edges where they are edges that are known, and then randomly populate the middle of the space to make sure there's nothing else in the middle that's a discontinuity we were unaware of. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why fuzzing is just right, right? That's a good, valid testing methodology for covering the part of the space where we believe there are no edges, and doing a statistical verification that there are no edges.
Yeah, but once again, I've used fuzzing for finding vulnerabilities in commercial software, and it was not for, well, it wasn't for malicious purposes, but it was to try to uncover these vulnerabilities.
It was protection testing.
Yeah, it's protection testing. You're right. Yeah.
That's right. It's not trying to break in, because you can break into the system, right?
Right.
The way you'll see in another segment of the show, if you listen to the show, you'll hear segments from Ira Winkler talking about, you know, how he gets into facilities. And, you know, I've done this, you know, red teaming and so forth for a long time. But we architect it as a test. We're trying to find all of the vulnerabilities at every layer of protection. In terms of getting in, it's simple, right? Walk around the perimeter, find cigarettes on the ground. Take out a cigarette, lean against the wall, wait for somebody to come out to take their smoking break, and follow them when they go back in. It's not going to take much of a test. You want to get in, you can get in, right?
Yeah.
Gun to their head and say, we're going in the facility. It will work.
Yeah.
And so forth. There's no question there's ways in. That's not the question. The question is, was the security system architected against that threat? If it's not architected against a nuclear explosion going off outside the door, disrupting services, there's no reason to test it for a nuclear bomb set off outside the door, because right. we know it's not going to work.
Right. We're not making guarantees for every possible contingency.
Right. The notion is that if I've done my job well, I've architected the protection scheme against a design basis threat to do specific things it's supposed to do. And mm-hmm. that's what I'm trying to find out whether it does. I'm not generally trying to find out whether there's a way in. There is. Do you do protection testing or do you do penetration testing?
I do both.
Okay, so when you do penetration testing, are you saying that you're given an unlimited range of things you can do?
Pretty much in a cyber range scenario. So I'm not actually attacking a real system, right? To penetrate,
right.
It's more of is this within the realm of the possible?
No, it's not within the realm of the possible. It's within a constrained realm of what you've been authorized to do.
Right.
Remote, you can send sequences of bits remotely into an interface, into a defined interface. That's the rules. Over this period of time with no more than this volume of them.
Right.
And only into that system. You can't go into the interdependency chain.
Mm-hmm.
That's not penetration testing, Brett.
That's true. It's still protection testing. Yeah, I agree.
Right. You have a defined. So that's the issue, right?
Yeah.
I'm trying to scope. I believe I have some set of defenses in place. I want to scope out whether they're doing what they're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right.
And I think that's perfectly valid. I mean, I think whatever you've done, if you don't test it, how are you going to know it works?
Right.
My goodness. You know, I mean, you write software. Right? Have you ever written software of any substance and not had to test it and not found anything wrong with it?
Never. It's always got problems. It always has flaws.
Yeah. Even in the days of punched cards where you worked it all out and you did all the math and you calculated everything and you checked all the instructions, it still didn't work the first time, right?
Yeah, I proved that I can actually demonstrate the halting problem. Where I get an infinite loop. It never halts.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. That's easy to demonstrate.
So back in the day with those time-shared machines, you know, the IBM 360, what happens was you were given you were given a certain amount of computing time with the processor. And if you exceeded that, they just stopped your program. So it did halt. They halted it for you. But then, of course, you knew that there was a problem with your program, that it didn't, that you...
Yeah, you don't know what the problem was, but you can look again. Yeah.
Yeah, it was flawed.
Yeah, so that you have to test whatever you do. And by the way, this was also true in your automotive experience, right?
Yes.
I mean, you know, you never said, oh, here's a sensor that detects whether I'm going to run into something. I'll put it on the front of the car and not worry about it. No. First, we're going to simulate it. Then we're going to check the sensor out independently. And eventually, we better put it on a car.
Yes.
So protection testing is the same as any other field of endeavor. You need to test it. And by the way, this is one of the areas where electricians are beyond my perception and understanding. Because when they built my house, they put in the wiring for the lights. They didn't test the wires end to end. I was like, you've got to test every wire end to end. They say, no. They put in all the wires, they sealed up all the walls, they connected all the lights, they flipped the switch, and it turned on.
Wow.
Wow. They didn't test every wire in advance. And I was like, how can you do that? Okay, you know what happens? If it doesn't work, I guess that light's not going to work. Either that or they're going to open up the wall.
Yep.
But it's sufficiently reliable because, you know, wires are pretty good at carrying electricity.
Right. Yeah.
The time and effort associated with testing the standard wires they bought from the standard place to make sure that electricity flows, current flows.
Right.
So it's not worth it.
Yeah. And also you have, is it ethical for them to just use those, the punch connections in the back of the outlet, or should they actually take the time to make their fish hook and connect the leads from the roam?
From the Romex into the screws. Yeah.
Into the screws. I mean, it's much, much safer to do the latter. Yes, it is, because you don't want those. You can have all kinds of problems with sticking the wires and crimping them in to the back of the outlet.
Well, so when you say that, the switches that I put into my kitchen,
mm-hmm.
the screw, you know, has this, I guess it's copper piece of metal, but you can set the wire into the looped part of that copper metal. You slide that that Romex wire into the looped part of the metal, and then you screw it down.
Oh, you can do that.
That's better than the J-hook. I think that's better and more reliable than the J-hook by a long ways. Because J-hook has a tendency to slide out.
Right. Yep. On your proficiency as a electrician, right? So whether you wire the right length so you don't have any exposed, you know, bare wire.
Well, I'm an electrical engineer, but I've put in enough switches so I get the wires approximately the right length and I don't leave any extra.
Right.
But on the other hand, the last set of stuff I put in, the screws, when I screwed in the screws, they weren't properly horizontal.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told by my son-in-law, who, you know, does this for a living, that I better turn those screws back to the left so that they're properly horizontally aligned.
Hmm.
So, you know, and it's a little bit tricky, you know, getting those plates to set on right without being at an angle.
Yes.
It's not as simple as it looks. You know,
I know. I've done probably over 100 of them. So I'm not as good as your son-in-law.
But me either, but the wires were right. Right.
Yeah,
I did want to make sure that I didn't get any sparks or that it didn't come apart and that there were no exposed wires. Right. And when I tested them, I did test them properly as opposed to electrocuting myself, which I didn't do once in the kitchen. I did it in the bathrooms.
Yeah.
But I asked my wife to stand by because I was about to test this. And in case I, you know, needed a heart restart. I want to make sure she was there. I did, you know, I wore gloves and stood at the other side of the screwdriver and had rubber-soled shoes, but that doesn't mean that I won't screw up.
Right.
That's why we test.
Right.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Tuesday, April 25th, I will be at the RSA conference meeting Cyber Companies. Email us at thecybershow.co if you want to be interviewed there. Friday, April 28th, all afternoon, the CSUMB Startup Challenge finalists will be at the Otter Student Union. Contact the IIED at the university for details. Tuesday, May 2nd, our Angel to Exit monthly advisory session will be held live online remote. To join us, sign up at thecybershow.co. Tuesday, May 9th at 9 a.m. go to Angel. Present your company and get on the show. Tuesday, May 9th, at 1 p.m., join the All.net members forum to discuss cybersecurity issues. For more details and to sign up, go to thecybershow.co.
This segment of our show is on artificial intelligence, or as I like to say, ay-ay-ay-ay-ay. Apparently, the newest AI techniques have been temporarily shunned by fraudsters who are doing foreign currency frauds. According to sources at the Electronic Crimes Task Force, these fraudsters have decided to retain their misspelling, poor language usage, bad capitalization, and related flaws in their emails. The rationale they give is that if it looks too good, the victims won't believe that they're ignorant foreigners. When asked for more details, they explain that they are ripping off dumb people. Anybody who's not smart enough to know it's a fraud will be fooled by the bad language into thinking it's credible. Yet another use for AI down the tubes because of human inadequacy. Another interesting piece of information from that event indicates that the inability of modern generative AI to come up with consistent answers, the ease with which it is fooled, and its inability to explain how it comes to its conclusions makes it unsuitable for use in most forensic applications. It appears that the use of these technologies for legal purposes, and particularly in court, is going to remain problematic for some time to come. Finally, the use of deep learning AI for detecting viruses has proven problematic because while it does a decent job of detecting many known viruses, in order to trick these methods, it's often possible to simply add one byte to a known virus to fool the detector. While this only works about 1 in 100 times, simply adding every version of one byte means that you'll get 2 successful viruses for each byte you add.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're talking with Simpson here, who has a long career, both as a cybersecurity, we'll call it threat actor for the moment, and as a journalist. No, it turns out I've never run antivirus on any of my systems.
No. I hope you don't get what I have then.
No, I think the way you avoid getting viruses is by not doing things that are stupidly obviously going to produce them, like running Windows.
Yeah, there's that. NIST won't let me connect to their computers unless I'm running antivirus on my computer.
Right. So what you do then is you run a virtual machine.
I've been trying to do that, but I got a new Apple laptop and it has the ARM chip in it. And
yeah, I understand. So try one of these.
It's a Chromebook.
It's a Chromebook.
And?
So you have all your meetings with them on Chromebooks, whatever it's they want to connect.
I want to access
the VPN. You buy a special Chromebook for the purpose, right?
I want to access the VPN to get at my NIST mail.
Yeah, but you can do that from a Chromebook.
No, because the F5 endpoint validator won't run on that.
Ah, there you go. I guess if you decide that you're willing to suffer the consequences, you can buy a completely separate non-Chromebook computer for that.
I was thinking of running Windows in the VM with the synthetic CPU also.
So buying a separate computer is a couple $100, and it provides you a much higher level of surety of separation.
But then you have to carry it around. It's a real pain.
You can get them pretty small, but yeah, look, it's up to you. You live your life. All right.
Yeah.
So last time we were talking,
yes,
we had, you know, moved on to where you were ready, I think, as I recall, to start graduate school.
Yes.
So talk about it. What did you do when you were now graduate?
I went to journalism school at Columbia because it was the shortest program that I got into.
It was so you a became 9-month a journalist.
Program. Well, I was a journalist before I went to journalism school, right? Because
no, but now you became an officially degreed journalist. Did you have a press pass, like, you know, like one of these press passes or what?
I'm thinking about that. So I've never had a press pass like that. I had a card from the National Association of Science Writers. And some people take that as a press pass, but the press pass that you just showed up is not an official press pass.
It is, in fact, an official press pass, but it's not a White House press pass.
Right, it won't get you into the White House.
Well, no, that's a different, that's a very specific pass.
Yes, so it turns out that the press passes that matter are the ones issued by organizations, not the ones issued by news organizations, by governments.
Well, it depends on where you're going, right? So if you're going to conferences, a professional, and so forth, then you can almost always get in with as an authorized member of the press with the.
I never had a problem getting into any conference for free, just telling them I was a freelance writer.
There you go. Perfect. You go. Good. Okay. Yes. So you packed your way past that one.
I have.
As did I for many years. I only got my official actual CBS News affiliate press pass, in the last couple of months. So, but
yes, it's beautiful.
Isn't it? It looks pretty.
It may, if you were a member of the mob that stormed the Capitol in January of this year, having a press pass like that might have prevented you from getting arrested.
And next time I go and storm the Capitol of some country,
you should be sure to have your press pass.
I will certainly make sure to have my press pass with me and up to date. Absolutely. Okay, good. Good advice. Okay, so
I went to one of the, not the first, but I think the second or the third Computers, Freedom, and Privacy Conference. And when I graduated journalism school in 1988, there were not a lot of jobs for journalists because the stock market had just crashed and it was the beginning of a major recession. And so I started doing freelance writing and computer consulting side by side. But I did go to the early Computers, Freedom, and Privacy Conference because I was always interested at the intersection of computers and privacy. And one of the things that happened at that conference was, for those who are listening who don't know, the goal of the conference was to invite law enforcement and computer hackers and computer security practitioners and academics to all get together and mix it up and to have like a nice, safe environment where people could have discussions. And immediately one of the things that started happening was that the computer hackers who were there, and they were really mostly phone freakers, started making fake registration badges so that they wouldn't have to pay the registration fees. And the conference organizers thought that this was really inappropriate. And I was thinking at the time, well, what are you expecting, right? You know.
Right. If you invite a thief, what do you expect?
If you invite a thief And then there was actually somebody arrested at one of the CFP conferences.
Did that have a killing effect?
They thought that he was Kevin Mitnick. And at the time, Kevin Mitnick was on the lam.
They thought he was Kevin Mitnick, so they did a false arrest.
They did. It wasn't Kevin Mitnick. Kevin Mitnick was too smart to go to that conference.
Or at least when he went to the conference, he had somebody else that was acting like him so that he wouldn't get arrested. They would.
Yeah. Yeah. So
I have to say, I don't assess people who were arrested and convicted of computer crimes as being the sharpest tools in the shed, considering how easy it historically has been to get away with this and never be detected, much less arrested, much less prosecuted, much less guilty.
I have a lifetime subscription to 2600, and I've met Emmanuel Goldstein, the pseudonym of the publisher, and I now have the on. I know somebody who was involved with the magazine very early on, and I see him frequently, and he said that the good hackers are the ones that never got arrested and that you never heard of. So,
right. Okay. So just so everybody knows, 2600, that's a frequency.
It is. The 2600 is the tone that the blue boxes were generating. The early long-distance telephone system used in-band signaling, specific tones, to cause the network to do different things. And the 2600 tone caused the long lines to reset and then to take a command. So you could reset it and then tell it to dial someplace else and get free phone calls that way.
Yeah. Or do other things that might have been much worse.
You could connect tie lines together and go from operator to operator to operator. You could impersonate as an operator. There were other tones that were the frequency that the phone made when you dropped a dime or dropped a quarter. And so there were these, those were called red boxes, I think, and could generate the electronic quarter tones and make free local calls.
Yeah, but it only went as high as a quarter. So probably if you were inventing the box, you wouldn't have bothered with the dimes and nickels. But the good part is if you could put in enough quarters, you could get change out of the machines, right?
No, they couldn't generate change. They could only release coins to the coin returner to the vault. The quarter tone was five nickel tones in a row. The dime tone was two nickel tones in a row. Remember from your very early days when you dropped the dime, you heard two tones.
Yep, ding, ding. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, that's all different now because we've gone back to inline signaling so that the internet, for example, is all inline signaling. So it's all in band.
Well, it's all encapsulated, right? So it shouldn't actually be in line. It's just the commands are quoted in a different way than the data is quoted.
It's all in band.
And,
right?
And it's at a well-run ISP, there's a management plane that is separate from the data plane. And so at a well-run ISP, you cannot actually get to the management plane, but increasingly, ISPs don't do that because it was just too difficult to run.
Yeah. Well, normally you actually can get to the management plane in my experience, but that's really not the issue. The issue is that the firewalling that does the separation of the different components so that the routing and switching doesn't listen to non-routing and switching information, all of that is problematic because once you have an autonomous system, an AS, you can change all the other AS routings, and we've seen this by mistake and by maybe not mistake multiple times, and it continues to happen despite the obvious simplicity of fixing it.
Yes, so that's the BGP authentication problem, and we haven't deployed BGP authentication the last time I checked, but there's supposed to be something called route filtering so that that you don't trust an announcement from an ISP unless it makes sense. There's a lot of BGP route filtering happening.
Yeah. So the makes sense is right. So here we see the technical back and forth that I think we hate so much in cybersecurity.
You know, this morning I was watching a set of documentaries on CuriosityStream about the Mumbai rail system, right? And in our world, we talk so much about analog and digital. And yeah, to be clear, analog is just an analogy. You know, it's not about using round or anything else. It's just, you know, make something that does the same thing as something else. In the Mumbai rail system, there are still in operation some analog systems where, like, a long steel rod, you know, moves one way across the rail yard, and you can't have two trains on that track. It physically can't work that way, right? And, you know, and then, and how that has switched in most Indian rail yards now to electronic systems, they're modeling that same thing. So everything we're trying to do in security or in information technology and digital technology at all is trying to make digital analogs of physical processes or other existing processes, you know, business processes and human processes. So anyway, you know, that whole, how you, you know, everything from press passes to encryption and authentication, right? You know, these are analogs for how we're doing things anyways. Like the intellectual property control these days in supply chain echoes the conversations 20 years ago in threat intelligence, which makes you look at how companies are controlling their intellectual property today. Now, how are you doing it? Kind of hoping my employees more or less know what contract legal signed and what they're probably not supposed to tell people. And it kind of works relatively well. But we'll make a digital analog that works at least that well, not some utopian ideal.
Another thing that I find seems like it's universal is I talk about a security load. But basically, I can't do this unless I can do that. I can't do that unless I can do that, and blah, 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 blah. And ultimately, what it causes people to do is to say, I will get around it because I'm trying to get my job done. It's like... Right. The more security you put in place that impedes me from getting my work done, the less I'm going to comply with your mandate. And yeah, eventually I'll just walk away from it. And I think it's not just security load. I think we have this horrible problem of the load of everything else in our lives. We've gone to a, you know, less paper, more digital, but because of that, because the digital system is so efficient at generating more crap, right? Man. You just have to answer that question another 500 times every day. And, you know, I need to authenticate, right? So I've authenticated to my phone, and then I have to authenticate to the app. And then I go to another app, I have to authenticate to that. And then the phone goes blank because of, it's not just saving power, but to make it more secure. So now I have to create. I mean, just how many times do I have to do the same thing again and again and again until it's completely meaningless and just something I want to disable?
Yeah, so the author David Brin wrote a great, great book called Kiln People, K-I-L-N, Kiln People. And it's a sci-fi Sam Spade detective novel based on the idea that we'll be able to make short-lived, you know, day-long lifetime copies of ourselves. We'll go out and do all sorts of things. We'll inload them at the end of the day. So we can live, you know, 5 days at once and send a bunch of copies off to do things, but then focus in on what we're actually doing ourselves, you know, the actual biological, you know, the archetype, the archy. In the novel is doing, right? And I think maybe AI is giving us the same sort of, you know, opportunity right now, because you're right. Over the last couple of decades, we've gone, I have more information and more things I should be doing and more, I need to more process more. And we're still awake for the same number of hours, right? Maybe, you know, AI, well, you know, this whole AI thing.
We sleep less because of it, but that's another issue.
Yeah, but it turns out there's not enough time. You can't stay awake long enough. You're not getting this one done. Maybe that's a big gestalt lesson we learn. I think it kind of is, right? You know, I think this whole ChatGPT thing going on right now, this whole AI large language model, call what you will, thing going on right now, will help us. And it may, this again, may take decades to play out, focus in on what is it humans actually do. Right. And yeah, checking off a longer checklist faster in our waking hours, I can't believe is really our biggest value add.
And making more mistakes, right? Because right, every decision is an opportunity to make a mistake. And no matter how good you are, you will make one. And as they keep telling us, which is not true, any mistake, the bad guys will win.
Well, early in my career, the controlled pause in public speaking, when you're on stage and literally everyone's staring at you and realizing you don't have to fill the time with you just stop, right? Literally stand there, count to three in your head silently. And I think the more meta lesson is, yeah, if you feel you have too many things to do, don't do as many. It's probably, your list is probably just your partial list of the things you think you really should do, which is even more ridiculous. You know, take a bunch off and give yourself enough time to think.
There are fairly recent results that indicate that when you take a pause in speech and don't speak too quickly, people will believe you know what you're talking about better because right. they believe that you're thinking about what you're saying, considering it, and then saying it properly, which is to say you're going to learn how to lie in a more effective manner.
Well, as security people, we can't help saying that.
See, now this is the other culture, the culture of interruption. You can't stand to have a half a second go by without somebody speaking, right? Which is
that's just me, I think.
No, no, it's not just you. It's not just me. It's a part of the American way, right? Any gap, any silence is an indicator that something's missing, and you better speak up, or what will happen to the world?
Well, yeah, to loop my social flaw there, let's lead back to the point you're about to convince me that since you can hack sincerity, there is what?
Only that as we publish information that helps us be more effective at communicating, that information is read by the good people and by the bad people. And the professional bad people look for every one of those and train and practice and get really good at it. Whereas the professional good people are usually too busy doing their job to have the time to practice and get really good at those things.
Well, but let's look at the, you know, the grand, you know, the grand political play out that's played out in our lifetime. Your geo-nationals, you know, not even, you know, we don't talk politics, however.
No politics allowed on the show, just.
But the USSR isn't here anymore. The USA is, right? In my lifetime, in your lifetime, that was a big question. Right. You know, which one would be more successful? Which one would outcompete the other one? And I would posit that, you know, the just moving forward. And in fact, my security advising and my security actions are based on a belief that moving forward and focusing on the things you can do is better than corrupting that process and spending efforts on other things. Right. You know, so, yeah, I guess my point is, you know, U.S. weapon systems or space race and everything else, you know, yeah, there may be secrets. However, mostly it was broadcast globally, whereas the Soviets were not, because the idea that you can keep that secret doesn't help.
I think what's more important is that we learned and we believed before that, and now we pretty much know that oppression has lower performance than support. So when you oppress people, they will do what you force them to do, but they will not do it very well. Look at the war in Ukraine and how the, you know, prisoners being forced to become cannon fodder don't like it, but they get shot if they go backwards. So they're just out there, you know, resigned to run forward and die and hope they only get wounded and picked up by the right side, right? Whereas on the other side, the people are not motivated by oppression. They're motivated by a desire for freedom and by the, you know, their homeland and all the other things involved. And they're better at it. They're being better at it. They're doing better at it. They're taking the time to train and be professionals at it. And they're, you know, against the odds, I won't say winning, but certainly sustaining much better than you ever imagined they could have. And, and that's just another example of what I think is the real issue, that to the extent that you need people to do things in order to compete successfully, you have to be good to those people. On the other hand, when those people get to the point where they think it's their right for you to pay them, regardless of what they actually do, then you stop paying them and you have a lot of the problems that I think we have in the U.S. today with people are getting, you know, their expectations are way too high for the reality of the value that they bring.
Well, you know, and, you know, I agree with you basically across the board on all that stuff. But we're talking about, you know, the value, the effectiveness of value, value of ethics. Kind of at the, in this case, the soldier level, but I'm talking about as the, you know, officer or the leadership level, because when you go down that road, paranoia, you know, the old cliche, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. If you're doing stuff like that, you should be paranoid. Yeah. And all the other leadership are doing the same thing. And you have to take, you know, pragmatically, again, ethically right or wrong, it just takes a lot of time. It takes time and resources to slow you down as an organization.
I'm sure that Putin is rightly afraid of assassination from within. I'm certain that leaders of these sorts of governments are reviled and hated. However, I do see that in the United States, We also have people that wish to kill presidents historically, and occasionally they do, and they get their shots and so forth. So I think that when you gin up political violence, when you gin up hatred, when you, you know, gin up violence, when you try to crush people, these are different things that are done in different societies. All of those things tend to lead to violence. And I think the violence is waste, in my view.
It is. It's very expensive, right? And this is, you know, this supports my optimistic view on things, because I think that, you know, we are literally in an evolutionary world. You know, we're here biologically because we succeed in evolution. And we succeed in large part because we cooperate and work things out. We're very curious little creatures. And things that are inefficient and ineffective aren't the best way to do things. And they can, you know, and as we see in biological evolution, lots of crazy things existed for a long time until conditions got tighter than that, when the filter got more narrow. And I think these, you know, the same as the point of the show, I think these cyber systems and businesses, I try to support that whole grand global effort by advocating this on the one-by-one working group or corporation or whatever. You know, you are better off, we are better off, if we, in this case, do things transparently, ethically, honestly, not because Boy Scout said we should, but because it will save us money and make us more productive and competitive, right? When that argument wins, you don't have to win the philosophical war. You know, the world will change itself.
Right. The only pause I would put on that is you're attributing it to a what is debatable, whether it's a scientific or a religious perspective on things. I'm just going to take the scientific perspective because religion is not allowed on the show.
Tuesday, May 2nd, our Angel to Exit monthly advisory session will be held live online remote. To join us, sign up at thecybershow.co. Tuesday, May 9th at 9 a.m. go to Angel. Present your company and get on the show. Tuesday, May 9th at 1 p.m., join the All.net members forum to discuss cybersecurity issues. For more details and to sign up, go to thecybershow.co.
We're talking to Doug, who has spent a lifetime dealing with the issues of identity management and has consulted for many of the largest enterprises in the world in this arena. So you're doing these access controls by groups and users. Mm. And so when did provisioning come in? Was it at that point, or was it more around rules and roles?
Yeah, so that was really kind of the work that I started doing right off the bat. When you have a repository like an LDAP directory or Active Directory, it's typically not populated with anything. Where do we get the information to put in it? What's the authoritative source of that information if it isn't the directory itself? And how, what kind of protocols or mechanisms or batch files do we use to get information from authoritative sources into the directory so that it is then securely yet universally available to all of the applications that rely on it? So yes, from a provisioning standpoint, we quickly, we're still in maybe 95, 96, the concept of something called a meta directory came about. A meta directory was really important because that really was a directory that defined where all of its integration source data was coming from.
Right, so it wasn't the directory, it was the directory of directories.
Directory of directories, so to speak. Because in a way, you could look at an HR database as a directory. Very, like you said a while ago, very special purpose, right? Only supports that application or those applications that are within the HR suite. But nevertheless, it's a directory. But then there are several other directories that are out there that it could have been a whole host of things from benefits or healthcare, or you name it.
Okay. So for example, this provisioning thing is the mechanism by which you can say, well, does this user have access to that?
Right.
And to answer the question, you might say, well, is that person an employee? And if they're an employee, you can go into the HR database for employees.
Yep. Yes.
And if the data they're looking for access to is, for example, their retirement plan, mm-hmm. then from there you can go into the retirement plan. So this exactly. structuring of all the content strewn exactly. throughout the enterprise so you right. can find what you're looking for and automatically make access decisions in real time,
yep.
that's complicated as can be.
Yep, it was fundamentally important just to be able to tell if the person was still an employee, because like I said, they could have, you know, resigned yesterday or whatever. So right off the bat,
or been fired, yeah, or died,
or yeah, escorted. There's a lot of escorting out the door, in those
or moved up.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe they move it up to the Enterprise because there's separation of duties and other protective requirements.
Yes.
As well as from the financial gap accounting, right? There's separation of duties for who can, you know, create an invoice and pay it. Things have to get managed somehow because the automation doesn't know unless you do.
This is exactly where the rules and roles you were talking about before come in.
Right. You know, so you see this evolution, right? You know, and this is, I was just thinking, similar to when I was a kid, you know, looking at computers, you know, the expectations were thus and such. Instead, we've done entirely different things because it's hard for people to imagine getting that far into the weeds, right? You know, actually counting individual genomes and so on and so forth. The numbers are just sort of shocking. Similar with security and cybersecurity and cyber, you know, writ large. You know, it's hard to picture in 1980 or 1990 or, you know, more recently, how deep we're going to get into this. So you see in security this evolution from, okay, we'll have, as we talked about last time, some, you know, an authoritative source for identity or maybe a couple, to wait. We actually have to break this all the way down and replicate, make the digital twin for the organization and engineer the whole, all the way down, right? So distributed, right, federated, as it is in the real world. Yeah.
Well, and we're nowhere near that, and we're not maybe ever going to be that close to that because there are other problems that come up. You know, one of them is figuring out how to make those decisions and make those decisions consistently, right? So you look in the HR database and it says, well, this is their job title, right? And you look in something else and says this is their manager, and you look somewhere else and it says this is so-and-so. And so then there's the question of what's the line of authority, right? So now we have to start saying, well, your boss just said it was okay. Well, okay, how do we integrate your boss said it was okay into all these other authorities, check all the rules, and then we have an exception, you know, and what are the rules on exceptions, and what are the rules on the rules on exceptions, right? And so at some point, the decision-making process becomes more complicated than if we just said for each individual, you can do this or you can do that. And this is one of the sort of the interesting things that's going to come up here. At some point, there were more roles and rules than there were people and things that they could access. So it became so complicated. And then the other thing is the rules typically get executed in sequence, right? So if you make a little mistake in the sequence of rules, all of a sudden everything doesn't work right.
Well, you know, the funny thing is once you stop trying to take humans out of the loop, it gets really simple, right? You know, so Wednesday night I was at the Oak Hill, Florida waterfront committee meeting. You know, there were five people, one, you know, paid public employee, you know, Cone Evans, doing a great job, you know, running the show, plugged into the electronic systems with one of the members on Teams meeting, right, in this tiny little town. And you know, the humans in the mix continue to be there. We're not really trying to automate everything. You know, we have to understand that we're enabling people to do their jobs better.
So, yeah, so there are a couple of problems. One of them is you probably always need a way to bypass the mechanism, no matter what the mechanism is, right?
Even
if it's a bank vault or the door of the front of your house, you'd be able to get in if you're keeping.
Or a boat, yes.
Or whatever, right?
Yeah.
So, but the other hand is that the bad guys exploit those bypass mechanisms to bypass them. So there's always this trade-off and this decision about how complicated it has to be for who to do what and what are the cost factors. So there's no end to this. And this is why you really need to understand, do your governance well, architect your governance, make good decisions, and then the technology has to support whatever those decisions are. So this identity aspect of it also, of course, flows into the DBOM, Digital Bill of Materials, and the Software Bill of Materials, because those are the same things. That's directories. Yeah. They're inventories, and associated with the inventories are ownership and authorship, and everything has to get federated because, you know, there's no authoritative source of what I did other than me, right?
Right.
So it's going into the supply chain now. And it has to go into the demand chain, and it has to go into the management chain. There's a long way to go. And it's only been 25 years since Doug was doing this part. All right.
Next week on The Cyber Show, Bill punches cards, and the cards punch back. Simpson shuts down and starts up again.
and again, and again. John gets out of the army and gets back in. Doug breaks the rules and the rolls. More fraud, spies, and lies. All this and more on next week's Cyber Show.
A good time and bow. A good time and bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.